Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And from Granite State College, offering diverse bachelor's and graduate business degree programs online. Designed to help working adults advance, Granite State College, where quality matters. More information and registration at granite.edu.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Swimming, boating, or just sitting beside a beautiful, clear New Hampshire lake has to be one of summer's greatest pleasures. And the state has several policies and practices aimed at keeping that water clean, especially a 20-year-old law called the Shoreland Water Quality Protection Act. But even some of New Hampshire's biggest lake lovers don't always love this law. With its goal of keeping pollutants, salts, and other gunk from running into the water, it tells property owners what they can and can't do on their land. And sometimes they don't like to be told. At the same time, lakes face other challenges: climate change, invasive species, and a natural aging process accelerated by human activity. Let's hear from you as we look at lake health in New Hampshire. What have you noticed about your favorite lake? The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests with us in studio. Jason Obey is here, Shoreland Program Outreach Coordinator with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services, Wetlands Bureau. Jason, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Great, thanks for having me on.
Also joining us from DES is David Niels, where he's Chief Water Pollution Biologist and Director of the Jody Connor Limnology Center. And David, good to have you too. Thank you.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Amanda Lamoureux. She's Vice President of the New Hampshire Lakes Association, which advocates on behalf of the state's lakes and watersheds. And Andrea, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
And also joining us, James Haney, Professor with the Center for Freshwater Biology at UNH. James Haney helped establish the state's first lake monitoring program, engaging volunteers who observe and report on the health of their local lakes. And Professor Haney, it's really a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, I want to start with you, Professor Haney. When it comes to keeping these beautiful lakes clean, who's responsible? Whose job is it?
Well, it's a combination of things, obviously. The state's very important, but from the introduction where you saw that I began one of the, or I helped begin one of the first lake monitoring programs, we obviously feel that the people ultimately are the ones that have to protect the lakes. So we also find that having them invested in the lakes is a wonderful educational experience. So it comes natural then to do the right thing rather than have to have rules for everything.
So my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Professor Haney, is the water itself is a public asset. It's owned by the public. But the shore around the water that's so important for keeping that water clean is often mostly privately owned. Is that right?
That's an excellent point. Yes, that's why that what people do around the lake, of course, is oftentimes more important than what happens actually on the water. So having these people that are owning and using the shorelands actually know the right and wrongs of how to protect the lake is very important.
What about you, Andrea? Is there an inherent tension to that? It's publicly owned, but to access it and to protect it, it's a private responsibility often.
Yes, yeah, certainly there's some tension there, but ultimately we're all in this together. Whether we live along a lake or we visit New Hampshire or we live far away from the lakes are so good for us and our economy for so many reasons. And there are plenty of places, if you don't live right along the lake or the pond or the river, there are plenty of places to access these waters. Lots of public access points maintained by fish and game and state parks and even towns.
Can you explain, Andrea, just how what is around the lake matters a lot? Because some of these lakes have, you know, big
you know, have a little forest, or they've got all sorts of fields before the lake. And some of them, I was just driving around yesterday, actually, I was practically next to the lake in my car.
Sure. The best thing to have next to a lake is obviously completely forested, lots of plants and trees, because those plants and trees are really good at soaking up any pollution or water runoff off the landscape. But obviously, we want to be able to be next to the lake, too. So if we're going to have a road or we're going to have a property or a home, we want to try to leave some of those shrubby things, some of those plants along the shoreline at a minimum to help soak up some of that pollution or the water that might be coming off the landscape.
Just explain how that works, Jason, if you could. How, you know, an innocent looking little shrub actually plays a really critical role.
Well, it certainly does. Andrea touched on that nicely. The key vegetation along our shorelines, they play a critical role in absorbing many of the nutrients that are found in stormwater, phosphorus, nitrogen, those critical components that play a major role in decreasing water quality. So really, in short, you want the plants to absorb those nutrients rather than having them directly discharge into our surface waters.
So grass, not so good, bushes better, trees best? I mean, can we do a hierarchy there?
A natural system is best of natural ground covers, shrubs, saplings, and a mature stand of trees. They serve many purposes, not only just for, soaking up or absorbing nutrients, but they provide a lot of shade over the shoreline, which actually helps milfoil not get established as readily, which is another hot topic. I'm sure it's been discussed on other shows.
Well, yeah, we've done a lot on that. And we will definitely talk about that this hour, because in addition to shoreline protection issues, invasives are a big issue. So I'm guessing, you know, people are thinking, okay, trees, that would be great. They're big. They have big root systems. That would really help clear the water. But if there's a big tree on my property, I can't see the lake, and then I don't have that beautiful view.
Certainly.
So what do you tell me about that if I'm a property owner?
What I tell you is that certainly we're aware of the fact that, you know, everybody wants a view of the surface water. What the Shoreland Protection Act does, it tries to strike that balance between allowing for views of the surface water while allowing some trees to remain to provide that nutrient attenuation to absorb those nutrients and provide those benefits to our water quality.
And just to clarify, nutrients, you know, sounds good, right? I mean, it sounds like a breakfast cereal, you know, nutrients. But nutrients in this instance are not good.
Not so good. We want to feed the plants on land and not the algae that's in our surface waters. But just want to touch on that cutting trees often is permissible. It can be done, but there are limitations.
What do you worry most about, David, in terms of, you know, stuff running off, gunk getting into the water? Is salt the worst? Is phosphorus the worst? Is fertilizer the worst? What's the sort of public enemy number one?
I think we worry a lot about stormwater and everything that's in stormwater. Salt is obviously sort of a hot topic that we deal with on a regular basis. We see conductivity, which is a measure of the amount of salt in the water, increasing around the state in our lakes, ponds, and our rivers. So
really?
It's very common. We see upward trends around the state of conductivity.
Our lakes are getting saltier? Is that what you're saying?
Our lakes are getting saltier. It's not just salt. There's any particle that has a charge to it will increase the conductivity, but we believe that a lot of it is due to salting that occurs.
Wow. Why do you suppose that's the case?
Well, I think people are just trying to treat their roads, trying to treat their property to keep the de-icing, try to de-ice the area and reduce the, you know, incidence of injury. And people are applying salt everywhere, and there's ways to do it the right way, and there's ways to do it not so good. A lot of people apply way too much salt. And whether you apply way too much salt or just the right amount of salt, it does get into our waterways.
Mm. What happens when a lake or a river gets a little too salty?
Well, it can impact the aquatic life. We have thresholds or standards for chloride, which is a constituent of salt, obviously, and it can impact the aquatic life.
I want to invite our listeners to join us, and then I have so many more questions for all of you. The exchange number for you to be part of our conversation: what do you observe about your favorite lake? 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Professor Haney, what do you think? What's public enemy number one when it comes to stuff being washed into our lakes?
Well, we pretty much convinced ourselves and a lot of other people that phosphorus is one of the most important things. phosphorus stimulates growth of both the good algae and the bad cyanobacteria, so that putting phosphorus in a lake can increase the productivity, but unfortunately it also encourages the wrong type of growth.
So productivity, but not in a good sense.
That's right.
Is phosphorus part of fertilizer that people use in their lawns, or where does it come from?
Well, I often think of us as sort of bags of phosphorus. You know, we contain lots of phosphorus. Most of the things we do also releases phosphorus. When we cause erosion of the soils, it releases phosphorus. When we fertilize the lawns, obviously, that releases phosphorus. But also, it turns out that even salts that we put on the roads contain some phosphorus, depending upon their purity. So that most of the things we do in terms of activities around the lake can contribute to the increase in phosphorus levels.
You know, I'm kind of surprised, Andrea, at this point, given what we know now about salt and water and the importance of protecting lakes, and you mentioned the huge economic and recreation benefit, I'm kind of surprised we don't have better, you know, road salt, like some other type of substance that doesn't harm water quality.
That's a great point, Laura. There certainly are some alternatives to the conventional road salt that are maybe have less conductivity issues, but they have other issues. But I know that the Department of Environmental Services and UNH are researching alternatives to road salt. But again, I think what Dave mentioned earlier will go a long way with people using less of it. A lot of folks are using too much, and we're also often putting it on at the wrong time. So if we put it on at the right time, then it will help to reduce the overall use.
Really? What's the right and wrong time?
You don't want to apply it too early before a storm, but then you want to have the right timing so it's starting to melt. You don't want to apply it before it's going to rain. It's all about timing as well as the amount.
Wow. I had no idea. Let's bring our listeners into it. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Jerry's in Freedom. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. I'm Jerry Kinrick. I'm a state representative representing Freedom. And prior to that, I was the chair of the board of Green Mountain Conservation Group, which is dedicated to protecting the waters of Pecosopee and Massapequa Aquifer. And our area here, of course, our economy is very heavily dependent on the water recreation. And one big problem I see is when we see short-term economic gain placed ahead of long-term economic consequences. And this happens both in the planning board, where there's approval of developments near the lake that violate best management practices, and likewise even at the state. There was a bill to standardize the buffer zone as far as size, and people were there testifying that, well, really doesn't make any difference. There's no science about that. That's simply incorrect. Up here, the town of Ossipee is approving two major projects. One is building a gas station right on a recharge portion of the aquifer where they've already had a spill and we still have a plume underneath, and an expansion of a campground, which is in the floodplain, expanding it by about 240 units. And they really basically disregarded the input of the towns of Freedom and Effingham, who share this resource, in spite of the fact that this is a project of regional impact.
So who's the sheriff, Jerry? I hear you. It's a huge resource. Lake Ossipee's beautiful. I've been there many times. You've got a couple towns on this lake. Some towns have one set of sort of values, and some towns have other sets of values. So who's the person who comes in and says, you know, no, this is bad for the lake?
Well, this is difficult. On the expansion of the campground, actually, our organization heard about it by a person who just happened to notice it, a member, who let us know, and we got involved with the towns of Freedom and Effingham to object to it and ask for a granting status of project of regional impact, which they did. But then they've gone ahead and simply ignored the input, and actually Freedom has taken Ossipee to court, which is kind of an unfortunate way to have to go, but they're really not taking into account that if you contaminate the water on the Ossipee side, you're going to impact the other towns because it's a shared water resource, and even all the downstream towns going all the way to Saco, Maine.
Is there a middle ground, Jerry, in this? You know, okay, build your campground, but make sure you have lots of shrubs.
Well, actually, in this particular case, the campground's being built almost completely on the 100-year floodplain and some of it on the 10-year floodplain. And we're not talking a primitive campground. This is going to be RVs who have sheds with gas cans and septic hookups and all kinds of stuff. But, you know, good development that follows best management practices, siting away from water, having buffer zones, not building on a floodplain, All those are going to be things that are really quite reasonable to do. But, and in fact, some of these policies were in place in the time of OSP, and they just decided to grant variances to what they had set in place before in order to allow these projects to go through.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for calling in. Wow, Andrea, I'm not going to ask you to comment on the specifics of this instance, but sure, definitely hearing from Jerry, you know, a tension between economic development and jobs, and, you know, everybody will enjoy being at that campground, I'm sure, with some real concerns about its impact on lake health.
Absolutely, Laura. When any development or project is proposed near a water body, there are certain rules and laws and policies and best management practices. And the Department of Environmental Services in particular, you know, works with project folks to on those. What, taking a step back with the New Hampshire Lakes Association, what we try to do is encourage local folks who are passionate about waters or passionate about their natural resources to get involved in the local planning process. And that means getting on your conservation commission and your planning board and your select board. It's the people who care about the lakes. If you're going to start getting involved, if you want to really make a difference, it's getting into your local government and helping to make and guide those decisions. There's a lot of rules and laws out there, and some folks don't know them. And by having more people who care about the resource helping to guide project developers through that, I think we can come to a nice compromise in many situations. Mm-hmm. Some where there's always going to be those tricky projects that, you know, DES and others are going to have to get thoroughly involved in.
So, Jason, what does the Shoreland Protection Act say you can and can't do?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know that's a big question. What does it say you can't do?
Well, if I could put it in a nutshell, first of all, you know, the law is, in traveling around the state and giving hundreds of these presentations, folks seem to think that the Shoreland Protection Act is just a law for protecting trees, and it goes well and beyond that. What the law is trying to do is trying to better manage stormwater and keep that wildlife habitat component in place. In terms of cans and cannots, there are not a whole lot of, you know, cannots. The law tries to strike a balance between, you know, recognizing New Hampshire's property rights, wise economic growth and development, and providing a level of environmental protection. So constructing new homes, certainly, and driveways, expanding existing structures, they're all permissible activities with a shoreland permit. Through that permitting process, we look at each and individual project and try to work with property owners and local officials to ensure that that it meets the minimum standards of the law and it is providing a level of environmental protection.
So almost 1,000 lakes in New Hampshire, 1.3 million people, plus never mind how many summer people. How many people do you have to check up on all these projects?
Great question. I do spend a little time in the compliance arena these days. Because we're understaffed, you know, and I think we only have maybe two people full-time devoted to compliance in the state of New Hampshire, three part-time folks. There is an uptick in the economy. There is a lot more activity out there these days, and we are under a lot of stress and heavily burdened today, there's no doubt.
Professor Haney, you've been working on this issue for a long time, as I said. How well do you see us striking this balance that Jason mentioned, that our caller Jerry mentioned about, yeah, you know, they want to build a campground, they want to build a gas station, but then there's the health of the lake. How well do you think we strike that balance?
Well, excuse me. In some ways, I think we have to look at this not by the number of people that are causing problems, but by really the number of people that we have enabled to live around lakes without causing problems. So I think we're always going to find quite a number of people who will break rules. But in fact, we've done quite a lot with improving this. And if you look at New Hampshire compared to some other states, I think we're well ahead of those in terms of our education through these rules, but also then by the compliance of people voluntarily.
All right. We'll talk a lot more in just a moment. And you can join us like Jerry did, 1-800-892-6477. Tell us about the health of your favorite lake, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment.
on the latest Outside In podcast.
I started convulsing or spasming on the ground, and I couldn't even sit up.
What if you could get rescued from anywhere on the planet?
You know, it's like, we're going to die, we're going to die. Nope, we're going to make it.
But what happens when not everyone gets the same chance to be saved?
The difficulty obviously rises when affluence gives one person a better chance of survival than another person.
Download Outside In on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the health of the state's abundant lakes and hopes for the swimming and boating season. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Join us. How healthy is your favorite lake here in New Hampshire? What changes have you noticed over time? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, spent the first segment really talking about the Shoreland Protection Act, a big, big tool in the state's toolbox to keep lakes healthy. And Jason, you talked about what it says you can and can't do. I wonder if anybody else wants to add into that. Maybe you, Andrea, as well, because I'm guessing you've done a lot of presentations on this as well. Just broadly, if someone said to you, what can and can't I do under the Shoreland Protection Act? What would you say?
I would say the Shoreland Protection Act allows you as a person along a lake to take some really great steps to protect your investment or protect the thing that the reason that drew you to that property in the first place.
Your investment meaning the water.
Absolutely. Yeah. It provides you some relatively simple things that you can do. So I don't see it as really restrictive, more as it's a tool to help you really make the most of your property and the resource that you're there in the first place.
So it doesn't mean you can't build a dock. It means you just have to do it the right way.
Occasionally it may say you can't build a dock, but you can do X, Y, and Z instead.
Or you can't, you maybe can cut down that tree, Jason. You said that earlier, but you need to think about it more holistically.
Sure. You know, there are some limitations certainly, but it's I think what Andrew started to touch on, it's we try to get the property owners to recognize that that connection between the vegetation on the shorelands and protecting that asset, which is the water quality. And that's one of the important pieces we try to bring home in our outreach efforts.
You know, our colleagues at NHPR's Outside In did a great story a while back called Peer Pressure, peer spelled P-I-E-R, about the conflicts that people have over whether they can build on their waterfront, and specifically about a man who was very upset that he had to take his illegal dock and deck down. We've linked to this story on our website, and if you're interested in New Hampshire lakes, you know, you really should give it a listen. But in the story, longtime State Representative Judith Spang made the point that while one little dock might not seem like much, the effect can be cumulative. Let's hear.
So if you have little docks like that all around a small water body, then it matters. If you gradually get rid of the habitat acre by acre by acre where a certain wildlife species lives or nests or whatever, then cumulatively, eventually, you've wiped out that wildlife species.
Professor Haney, how well do you think the general public understands that little by little impact? You know, well, I just dumped a couple buckets of sand because I wanted my kids to have a little sand when they ran into the beach. Or, you know, well, I just put that little dock there and, you know, it's small. It's not a problem.
Well, I think part of it is also understanding how little aggravation it takes to change the lake. In fact, in terms of phosphorus, just a teaspoon of phosphorus in a lake can cause quite a dramatic effect on that part of the lake. So we're not talking about huge effects, rather huge causes, getting large effects. One of the other things that I think is important is to understand that the property owner is one of the persons invested in this, but also the communities should be looking at it this way. The health of the lake is also related to the health of the community. So I think that is, when that catches on more so, I think we're going to find that there's much more pressure to do the right thing for a number of reasons.
And phosphorus, again, largely comes from fertilizer, Professor Haney, is that right, that people put on their lawns?
Well, that's only one of the sources. Phosphorus is, of course, a natural component of the soils, of some of the rocks. It's also part of a lot of the activities we do. Even gasoline, for example, has phosphorus in it. So when you're running a motorboat, you're also contributing phosphorus to the system.
Well, speaking again of property owners and trying to do the right thing, and as you all have mentioned, a lot of them really want to because they're invested in the lakes. Our senior producer, Ellen Grimm, spoke last week to Dave Birchenow. He lives year-round on Lake Nubbenusset. He's part of a volunteer lake assessment program. And Ellen asked him how he keeps his own property lake-friendly.
I don't put any fertilizer near the lake at all. And although when I bought the place back in the 1990s, there was some grass up to the lake, and that's pretty much turned to weeds at this point because I just don't use any fertilizer or grass color anywhere near the lake. And it's the same is true with buildings. You just don't build anywhere near where the Shoreland Protection Act says you should not build. It's not difficult, but some people don't like that.
It's not difficult. Again, that's Dave Birchenow talking about how he makes his lake property lake friendly. What do you think, David? It's not difficult.
I think he's absolutely right. I mean, Dave is one of 500 volunteers that we have in the Volunteer Lake Assessment Program around the state, and they're well-versed in the responsible management of their property, and they spread the word statewide. And we talk to these people regularly, and they don't have a problem complying with these regulations. And it, I guess the way I look at it, it's really a guidance document for them to responsibly develop their own property.
Go ahead, yeah.
No, and I was just going to say there's a whole host of other volunteers that do a lot of other things for lake protection around the state, both at UNH and the Lakes Association. So these people are there are our special army out there that help spread the word around the state of New Hampshire and really help keep an eye on things for us. And we rely on them, and they do a great job. And if they can do it, everybody can do it.
Well, and, talking about what he does on his property and so forth, I wonder, too, I think I asked somebody this earlier, but Andrea, how well do you think most people understand this?
I think there are some people that get it really well. There's always, those that are quick on the uptake, the first adopters. But we really are, as Dave said, we're relying on these volunteers, these folks, to set the benchmark and to model this these practices for others. You know, typically people don't, they learn better from their peers and their neighbors. So we want the neighbors out there showing, you know, hey, I can do this. You know, it's pretty easy. It didn't cost me a whole lot. And maybe they encourage their neighbor to do it. And, you know, it spreads more like that. That's a more effective way for people to choose to do something when they see their friends and others doing it.
Instead of, which I have heard, and again, this is from the Outside In piece, people kind of acting like the snitch patrol.
Right.
Calling DES and saying, I saw a dock, I saw a beach.
Right. And that does happen. And certainly we appreciate that when it's an egregious type of a thing. But, you know, we really want neighbors out there not reporting each other, but collaborating with each other and saying, hey, we both live around this puddle of water. How are we going to work together to keep it as nice as it was when we first arrived here?
Although, as we heard earlier from our caller, Jerry, sounds like some towns aren't agreeing on how the stewardship of the lake should continue.
Yeah, you know, there are different priorities in different areas. But again, the bottom line is, you know, there are some rules and laws that are baseline. And again, getting involved in your local politics and government will help to have a better, more positive outcome for the water and everyone.
Jason, is there a cultural difference in terms of, you know, this dedication to lakes that you have all talked about between people who live there year round and people who come in for, you know, 1 week during the summer?
Oh, boy, I don't know if I can speak to that, but there are varying degrees of caring.
And understanding.
And understanding. And what I find is, I've given hundreds of presentations around the state on the Shoreland Protection Act. And while traveling around the state, what I find is a lot of folks still believe that the Shoreland Protection Act is just a law about saving trees. And it goes much further than that, certainly. And our outreach efforts try to touch on the pieces relative to stormwater management and the role in which the vegetation plays in terms of absorbing and intercepting stormwater. So people are aware of the law. It is beneficial, and I'm certainly since it's been enacted, I think it is playing a significant role in protecting our water quality.
What do you see, Professor Haney? Have you seen a difference in the 20 years or so that this has been on the books?
I think it's helped a tremendous amount in terms of just awareness of the basic problems that we have with the lakes. I think the other thing that's important we haven't brought up is that lakes, we talk about lakes as though they were one thing. And in fact, lakes come in many varieties, just like people do. Some of them are more vulnerable to the problems than others. So I think the application of these general principles that the Shoreland Protection Act actually lays out very nicely, that they're more important in some lakes than others in terms of how immediate the problem is. Deep lakes tend to be less sensitive to change. They can absorb more nutrients. And shallow lakes, you have to be very, very careful with them. So I think each lake group or association or community has to get to know its lake to know how to deal with it.
That's interesting. Let's go back to our listeners. From the Lakes Region, Maureen joins us in Laconia. Hi, Maureen. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling with, well, I guess a comment and something positive, at least in our lives, about the lake. We own a small cottage business on the Weirs Channel on Lake Winnipesaukee, and we've owned it for about 19 years. And for years, every morning, our first job would be to go down and rake the beach. It's a 350-foot beach, and it would be covered very thickly with milfoil. And starting last year, we really don't have the problem and haven't had it this year so far. So I'm thinking it's probably because of something that's being done in other parts of the lake that are helping us. Do you think so?
Wow, that is great to hear. So I'm not sure who wants to take this. Are we winning the battle against milfoil, Andrea?
Maureen, that is great to hear. And what I think that's really pointing to is there's been a lot of work done in Lake Winnipesaukee by the Department of Environmental Services and all the municipalities, for the most part, around Winnipesaukee. There's six or seven municipalities, and they've been involved over the years in managing or actually removing the milfoil by certified weed control divers. They've really done a lot of great work, and I know the town of Laconia has recently really stepped up their program. So I would say, you know, as you know, you're sort of at the outlet there with, you know, everything sort of flowing by you guys, and the reduction in what you guys are seeing flowing by and washing up certainly is reflective upon the wonderful collaborative work that's being done by DES, the municipalities up there, and all the volunteers and certified weed control diving companies. So it's a nice partnership up there, and sounds like it's a success story right now.
Here's another email from Rick in Intervale, who also asks about invasive species. Rick says, what is the state doing to combat invasive species along shorelines, especially Japanese knotweed that is overtaking lake and stream shorelines? Anybody want to tackle that one? Throw it to you again, Andrea.
Initially, yeah. That Japanese knotweed is another invasive species. It's more of a wetland invasive species, but it is a plant that is not prohibited, is not allowed to be sold in New Hampshire. And I know actually the Department of Agriculture works a little bit more closely with managing that species. It's always good when you get fill or you're planting something in any area to really get clean dirt, clean fill, make sure it doesn't have any seeds left over from some other location. That's the primary way a lot of our terrestrial and wetland plants are being spread, is by in the seeds, in the seed stock in the soil.
Well, and as we know, Japanese knotweed is extremely powerful.
Yes.
Doesn't take much to get it going. Yes. Did you want to jump in, Jason?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that species like Japanese knotweed and other exotics, they can be removed from the protected shoreline at any time, and there are no limitations on that.
So that's okay, not one of those buffer plants that you want.
Sure, let's take care of it. Let's get rid of it and be done with it.
Is there any invasives, David, that actually help filter out the water, as you all described at the beginning of the program?
I would say there's no invasive that we want in our water bodies that actually help filter water. There certainly are some mollusks out there, zebra mussel, which most people are familiar with. Which is not here in New Hampshire, that would do a great job of filtering our lakes, but we definitely do not want it in our lakes. It is not one of the friendly invasives that we would want anywhere around here. It is in New England. In fact, it's over in Vermont. We don't have really the water chemistry that would support zebra mussels. At least we feel like we don't. So we're lucky in that respect, but we still ask people to keep their eyes out for it. But we've been really lucky so far, because that really kind of is one of the nastiest invasives that would really spoil a lake ecologically and for the lake goers recreationally. It's,
really?
Yeah, it's very sharp. It can damage people's feet when they're wading around in the shoreland. Shoreline area, it becomes very difficult to enjoy swimming.
So that's the zebra mussel.
That's the zebra mussel, yes.
And it's in Vermont, so it doesn't seem like it would take very much to, you know, cross the Connecticut River and come over here.
No, it really would not. And the Lakes Association runs a great program in tracking where boats go and come from in order to keep track of that possibility. And that's really the best way to prevent its introduction here into New Hampshire, is to really make sure that our vessels are taken care of and keep track of where they're coming from and going to.
And you mentioned earlier, David, that our lakes are getting a little bit saltier, which is not a happy prospect. Are there certain invasive species that enjoy slightly saltier water?
Invasive species typically are more tolerant of poor water quality, but there's not any real invasives that would take over because the water becomes more salty.
Professor Haney, do you have anything to add into that?
Well, only that in fact the salt content can also reflect the nutrients in general, so that as we get more phosphorus and nitrogen into the lakes, we're seeing the salt content come up for that reason as well. So I think it's something that is more general than just the application for de-icing. So I think it's something that is a good monitor to do to see whether those lakes in general are going up.
Let's take another call in Portsmouth. This is Dave. Hi, Dave. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
I have a question about what can be done about pastures that go right down to the edge of the water. And what can be done about camps that have been there for 50 or 60 years whose septic system has deteriorated, old 55-gallon drum?
Okay. Camps, septic systems, old septic systems, and pasture lands. I'm going to throw that one to you, Jason.
Sure. Geez, in terms of pasture lands, true bona fide agricultural operations, technically, they are exempt from the provisions of the Shoreland Protection Act.
Really? Even given what we know about, you know, animal waste and how that can really gunk up the water?
Correct.
And why is that?
Boy, there's a number of entities that came into play. Certainly, you know, when the Shoreland Protection Act was in its infancy, what property owners do have to do who are involved with these agriculture operations is use best management practices. Any complaints relative to these sites should be directed to the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture.
Okay. So farmland, true farmland, not somebody getting, you know,
not
two chickens and saying they're farmers.
Yeah, exactly.
is exempt. What about aging septic systems? I'm guessing this is an issue with a lot of little cottages, which are lovely, by the way.
Great question. It's not uncommon, certainly years ago, for folks to create a septic system by having a 50-gallon drum and putting a shot of buckshot through it. If someone detects one of these areas leaking or posing a problem, certainly we want to be notified so that we can jump in and take care of that.
All right. We've got a lot more questions from our listeners. So hold on. We'll be back in just a minute. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're diving into New Hampshire's lakes, looking at the health of our state's almost 1,000 lakes and what some of the threats that face our lakes are. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter as well at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So all of you have talked a lot about the Shoreland Protection Act and some about invasive species. I have a couple questions about lake health specific to this year, beyond these broad policy discussions that are ongoing. Last year we had a drought. This year we've had a lot of rain. Professor Haney, what does that mean for the health of a lake?
Well, judging from the past experiences we've had, when we have large rainfall, we tend to have a lot more nutrients coming into the lake.
And again, nutrients bad, not good nutrients.
Exactly. Well, it's the same stuff we put on gardens to make things grow, and so we get things growing. And so the lakes tend to be greener in wet years, and also they tend to be greener in warm years where you get plenty of sunshine. So what's going to be very interesting with this year is we've got the setup with the rainfall so far, and if we get the warm temperatures, we could actually see a remarkable year in terms of the growth of phytoplankton, of some of the problematic species, such as the bloom-forming species. So this is going to be very interesting, and of course it's tied in with the long-term changes that we have in weather, which is everything pointing to things getting warmer.
Well, and UNH scientists have predicted a warmer, wetter future in general for New Hampshire, although then you have years like the drought last year.
Exactly, and especially in the Northeast. This is one of the things that varies across the country, and that maybe overall we're getting warmer, but the Northeast is getting wetter as well. And that's very interesting.
Well, and I wonder if scientists like you, Professor Haney, need to adopt some different language, because when you hear the words nutrient, green, growth, it all sounds great.
It's very true. And if you look at the total productivity of lake and you plot it against the temperature, and southern lakes tend to be more productive, and that also sounds very positive. But if you look at the species that are there, if you're interested in catching cold water fish, for example, that will go down dramatically with the warmer temperatures and more nutrients, so that the things we value most disappear, tend to disappear with the warmer temperatures and the higher nutrients.
Well, and David, I read recently that several New Hampshire lakes have already been posted for cyanobacteria. Now, in some instances, those postings were taken off, you know, a couple days later. But what is cyanobacteria? It doesn't sound good.
Cyanobacteria is a, most people that are familiar with it, when I grew up, called it blue-green algae. The taxonomists have changed it to call it cyanobacteria. It's an algae. Most people would recognize it as an algae in a lake. And it can produce a toxin that can be harmful to humans, pets. And we do see it around our lakes. It's been around for, and Dr. Haney knows the subject really well, for about 4 billion years it's been around.
Not always toxic.
Not always toxic. It's evolved over time, but it has gained a lot of attention recently, and people are aware of it now, and people are tracking it now, and it can be very harmful to pets and humans if there's a bad bloom. And we do, as you mentioned, issue cyanobacteria advisories or lake-wide warnings when people discover it and we can identify it.
Is it visible?
Absolutely. It's we usually think of algae as a microscopic organism, but it usually presents itself as a bloom, and sometimes will appear as a blue-green scum on the top of the water if it's very calm out. Other times it can be suspended in the water, but it's visible to the naked eye. And when a lake is experiencing a bloom activity like that, it's very obvious.
So what does that mean for a lake, publicity-wise, Andrea, to be posted for this?
The DES does issue advisories, and then so there'll be a sign that would go up at a public, you know, beach area. It's really up to the owner of that beach to decide whether or not they're going to close or not remain open. But at least the people that might want to use the water are informed of the problem. They can go on the DES website and see, you know, what lakes are posted. But again, it's really up to the beach owner to decide whether or not they're going to close and shut down. But it's good to provide the swimmers, the people that are going to use it, with the information so that they can make their own informed decision as well. Certainly, we also advise folks, you know, there are, you know, a handful of biologists around the state keeping an eye on this, and we really rely, again, on people living around the lake, the volunteers, to look out their window. You know, we say, look before you leap. let us know, let DES know if something looks a little bit off color in the lake, if it's a greenish, unusually greenish or a turquoise tint. You may want to let DES know and send in a sample.
Wow. Did you want to jump in, Professor Haney?
Well, I'd like to say that there's been a lot of activity along this front, simply because worldwide the cyanobacteria outbreaks have been increasing. The number of deaths of pets and wildlife have also increased. But in response to that, there's some very positive things happening. One of them is that in the Northeast, we have a Northeast Region 1 from the EPA consortium that is developing a cyanobacteria monitoring program. And this is a very positive thing. New Hampshire DES is part of that. And we're simply getting organized so that we can track the changes and hopefully anticipate, especially for drinking water sources, anticipate when a bloom is going to occur so that you don't get and a high level of toxins coming into the drinking water.
Well, and this is probably coming full circle from where we started, Jason, but what's the best way for all of us to avoid cyanobacteria as a state, I mean, to protect our water from getting to that state?
You know, collectively as a state and as property owners on our lakes and ponds, we have a critical need to recognize the importance of better managing our stormwater and keeping vegetation in place where we can, and recognizing those areas where maybe we've cut vegetation or we've created a new lawn that we don't particularly care to mow much anymore. Maybe allowing more vegetation to take hold of our shorelines. But it's also another aspect to recognize is what we call knowing the flow, taking a look at the property and getting an understanding of when we have a rain event, where is that water flowing to? And is there any way that you could implement some system to ensure that stormwater gets infiltrated into the ground rather than running directly into the water?
Here's an email from Nancy who says, how do we get compliance officers to enforce obvious violations? A very wealthy family has purchased a great deal of Winnipesaukee properties in Tufton Borough and violated every aspect of the Shoreland Protection Act, taken down all trees, built children's playhouse overhanging the lake in Winter Harbor without a permit, and exceeded the amount of non-permeable surfaces, fertilizers, non-organic. The town of Tufton Borough states there's nothing they can do, as the family can easily pay the fines. Wow, Nancy. What do you think, Jason?
Well, goodness. First of all, we receive a number of complaints every day, and we rely heavily on lake associations, local code enforcement officers. We triage these complaints based on the level of environmental impact that they pose. If they feel that somebody is violating the provisions of the Shoreland Protection Act, that's something we want to know about. And that can be done easily by submitting a complaint form directly to us.
So they're paying the fines, but they're not taking the stuff down. The state say, keep your fines? We need to just take the stuff down. This is Lake Winnipesaukee. It's sort of the crown jewel of New Hampshire's lake system.
That's a misconception. There is this thought out there that folks can just pay the fines associated with it and be done with it. But that's not the case. First and foremost, the department, we look to educate these folks about the importance of the law first and also bring them into compliance by restoration. And that is achieved through a number of mechanisms. But always we seek to have properties restored so that the site meets the minimum standards of the act.
I've got two emails here from Lake Sunapee, one from Deborah and one from Barbara. Deborah says, I am fortunate to live on Lake Sunapee and have been attached to this lake for over 50 years. Wow, Deborah. The homes that are being built on the lake are huge. The gardens are lush, probably fertilized, and it has had an impact on the lake. Deborah says, what is most frustrating is people come in and pay one or more million for a house and they want a view, so they go ahead and violate the law, pay the fine. Who cares about the few thousand bucks in the grand scheme of things? So Deborah says stormwater runoff becomes far more damaging. She says our lake association has been extremely active but cannot provide enforcement. I got a similar email from Barbara, also on Lake Sunapee for many, many years. Excuse me, Barbara, I won't read the whole thing, but she also says she can recall when the water was so clear that the bottom was visible at 20 to 25 feet, no algae, few water plants. She talks about salamanders, crayfish, sunfish. Now she says Lake Clarity is lousy, the critters are long gone, the bottom and the rocks are covered with algae, the winter salt on the roads has exponentially increased, and she also says property owners around the lake break rules, despite the Shoreland Protection Act, to get what they selfishly want and accept a wrist slap. It is very disheartening. Wow. You know, I'm going to turn to you, Andrea, because, again, Lake Sunapee, another just dearly beloved lake by Granite Staters and visitors, and just frustration. People see violations and they feel like nothing's getting done.
Yes, that does sound frustrating. I do want to say that Lake Sunapee is still one of our most pristine and beautiful lakes. My family has a home there, and I've been going there for 30 years. But I would agree that we've seen, in Sunapee in particular, a little bit more algae growth, a little bit more sedimentation, due to a number of factors, certainly what people are doing on their properties and also what's happening on the roadways. And also with our changing weather patterns, we're having more runoff and more sedimentation and more of that nutrient, too much of that nutrient. So it's a combination of what we ourselves are doing and also how the weather is changing.
More runoff because we have these big, dramatic rain events instead of, you know, which we've always had, frankly.
Right.
But are we having more of that?
And what we're talking about with lake management is, as our weather patterns change, we may also have to change our approaches to lake management and change or improve or make even more protective the best management practices. You know, when we have bigger rainstorms, we're going to need bigger ways to hold back that rain. So I'm sorry to hear that. Certainly in some areas of our lakes, we are seeing that increasing. And that's also due to natural forces, too. But there are some things that we can do to reduce that.
So if we're going to get stronger rainstorms, and as you all have described, that's going to mean a lot of water with a lot of junk in it running into the lakes, and that's a problem. Are you suggesting, Andrea, that the Shoreland Protection Act might need to be beefed up?
I don't know that I'll go say that right now, but I would say that it would be wonderful if we had some sort of restoration program or incentive or act in this state. You know, a lot of our land is already developed around those lakes, and the Shoreland Protection Act, you know, provides some protection. But if there was a way to really incentivize and really encourage people, you know, your property may be in compliance with the Shoreland Protection Act, but there's certainly more things you could do to provide even more protection to the lake.
Jason?
Yeah, I just want to touch on the piece about impervious surfaces and cutting trees. Oftentimes we receive complaints about folks cutting trees and building new structures, and it turns out they actually have a permit. The activities they're engaging in are permissible. It may look a little aggressive to folks from the water side, but it ends up being a permissible activity.
Should it be permissible?
It is under the law today.
Yeah, and it's also towns play a role in this, right, Jason? I mean, towns have their own sort of ways of doing things, as we've heard from our listeners during this show.
Some municipalities have more stringent standards. There are a slew of towns that have much stricter local ordinances, particularly with respect to tree removal and even impervious surfaces mandating when stormwater management techniques be implemented. The more stringent standard always applies.
So pervious means what?
Pervious means it has the ability to soak up the rain, soak up stormwater.
So a dirt road is good?
Technically, a gravel roadway or a parking area is considered to be impervious. It doesn't have the ability to soak up a rain event. Maybe a very light rain event, but during a major storm event or a relatively strong rain event, there's stormwater traveling off those gravel impervious surfaces. There was once a 30% limitation on impervious surfaces in the protected shoreline that was removed in 2014. Now there's no limitation on impervious surfaces. If you do go over 30%, meaning 30% of your lot will be impervious, the law mandates that a stormwater management system be designed by a professional engineer.
Okay, so putting in layperson terms, so sort of pavement, hard stuff that rain just washes off of very quickly,
sure,
versus, you know, trees and grass. And
looking at a bird from a bird's eye view of your property, looking down, your roofs, your decks, your driveways, all those sheds are all those structures that cannot absorb the rain. It's traveling somewhere, likely downhill and towards the lake or the pond.
So when I said that a dirt road was good, Dave, you were shaking your head, but wouldn't that soak up more rain than, you know, pavement?
So a dirt road is probably better than a paved road. However, it's the way that the roads are constructed and the way the stormwater is managed. We actually have several lakes around the state that we have dirt roads that become problematic because they're not constructed properly, and the stormwater gets washed directly down in the dirt road, picks up the material on the dirt road, drags the phosphorus into the lake, and creates turbidity in the lake as well. And that can really create a long-term problem for the lake. It's a fantastic way to deliver those nutrients that we don't want in our lake to the lake.
So last question, I'll turn to you first, Professor Haney. What kind of weather this summer would be perfect for lake health? What are you hoping for?
I think if we just look outside, we're seeing it. We had the rainfalls in the early spring, some of the wettest month, I think, in May and now in June. And then we're starting to get the warm weather. So it turns out that the bloom-forming species just love this. They love having the warmest weather. In fact, when it's warmer than the good species, that is the good algae, can tolerate, they're at their best. So I see what we're getting now is the setup. And so far, we're seeing quite a number of cases of blooms occurring and people being called out to these blooms. And so I think this is going to be a landmark year for if it continues the way it is.
So you're hoping for cooler weather.
Cooler, cloudy weather would help.
Okay, well, that's kind of putting a damper on my plans to go camping in a couple weeks, Professor Haney. So
no, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. But I do understand what you're saying. Thank you all very much for being here. I really appreciate it. Important topic, especially as we head into the summer. Andrea, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Andrea Lemereau, Vice President of the New Hampshire Lakes Association. David, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Laura.
David Neal's Chief Water Pollution Biologist at New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Jason, thank you also for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jason Obi, Shoreland Program Outreach Coordinator for the state. And Professor Haney, thank you also. It's good to meet you.
Thank you.
That's Professor James Haney. He's with the Center for Freshwater Biology at UNH. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our interns are Alana Pearson and Edie Allard. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.